Are you someone who doesn't take life too seriously? Do you sometimes find that a shot of whiskey isn't only deserved, but needed? If you said yes to either of those, welcome to the Whiskey and Lace podcast, where we have honest chats with everyday people, shit shows and all. I'm your host, Erica Altus, and I'm here to empower you to be the best version of yourself and perhaps share in a shot of whiskey. Now pour yourself a glass of wine and let's go. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Whiskey and Lace podcast. Today's guest is one with a story that I know others will benefit and find inspiration from. This guest is one of Mark's six sisters, who grew up here locally and was baptized at the age of 15 into the Jehovah's Witness organization. She spent 28 years of her life baptizing the organization until she ultimately found herself in a position where it was time to make some very big life changes. She had been married for 22 years to someone who ended up having a substance abuse problem, and she ultimately decided to leave him simultaneously when leaving the organization. And if anyone is familiar with making just one of these big life changes, you know that they are massive decisions and incredibly hard chapters to close. She then found herself as a newly single mom to her daughter, who at the time was 9 years old, on top of losing so many people close to her. And let me just tell you guys, Mark and I witnessed what she went through, and I just want to say, this woman sitting in front of me picked herself up by the bootstraps and did a remarkable job at navigating being shunned by close family and friends, all while being a newly single parent, managing to continue to work full time to provide for her and her daughter off of her solo income. But she also managed to go back to school and get her bachelor's degree during all of this. I think it goes without saying that my sister-in-law is a total badass, and I'm so damn proud of her for coming out of this on the other side. Everyone, I'd like you to welcome my sister-in-law, Nanette, aka Nanny, to the podcast. Hi, Nan.
Hi, Erica.
Quite the intro.
I should call me Nanny Pants. That's also my
name. Yeah, she also goes by Auntie Nanny and Nanny Pants. You wear lots of names, or you have lots of names, but thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for helping me.
You're welcome. So before we begin, I just want to point out to everyone that this is a huge step and probably not the most comfortable step for Nan to be taking, being here in such a public way. So I just want to say thank you for having the courage to open up like with us here today. We're going to also point out that we're going to protect ourselves by saying we won't be diving deep into our personal family experiences throughout Nan's story. But regardless, I know so many people are going to feel less alone because you are here with me today sharing your story. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
So let's get into it. You are number four in the
number
family.
Five.
Oh shit. We're the same.
Same as you. Yeah.
Oh my God, I knew this. Yeah. You know, I'm already getting my details wrong. You're number five in the Altus family lineup, and your mom, not your dad, which is unique, decided to join the Jehovah's Witness organization when you were just about 4 years old. You essentially grew up knowing no different. And then by the time you were 15, you were baptized into the organization. Can you tell us what that was like to grow up in this organization and about how you came to the decision to be baptized?
First, I guess I would say I feel like I had a wonderful childhood. I had wonderful parents, siblings. We had a very close-knit family. I feel like it was a very normal, wonderful childhood. And like you said, I was four. I didn't know any life different than that.
Right.
I think as a young child, I was very much indoctrinated into the belief system.
Because you committed a lot of time each week to it. So like, tell us a little bit about that. Like,
by that, I mean, as you said, my dad was not a witness, never was. But my mom would have regular pioneers, which are sisters that were in the congregation that spent 90 hours a month preaching and having Bible studies.
Those are the people who go like knocking on your door, right?
Yeah, well, everybody goes knocking on their door, on the door. Everybody that's a publisher, you knock on the doors. But pioneers are ones who spend 90 hours at that time. It's less now, I think. But at that time, 90 hours a month going preaching.
Okay.
And so my mom always made sure that someone, we had a pioneer sister studying with me and my older sister, one of my older sisters. Every week, we'd have a weekly Bible study. She also would have an elder in one of the halls at one time would come over and study with us. And so it's pretty, you have meetings Tuesday and Thursday night and Sunday. You're usually out in service going door to door on Saturdays. So, I mean, you're very much indoctrinated into the belief system.
You're in it.
You're in it. I mean,
you really like almost have no time for much else besides, you know, family time and things like that.
But as far as the belief system from a very young age, you study the Bible and the literature from the organization. So, I mean, like, for example, there's a book called My Book of Bible Stories. It's this little gold book that everybody, it's a children's book of Bible stories. And there's a picture for each story on one side, and it depicts the characters from the book. And then on the other side, it's a page long that goes over the scripture and kind of what's going on in the story. And I can remember the elder that studied with me and a couple of my sisters, he had made flashcards out of those, and he'd hold up the picture and I could recite the scripture. I could recite the, you know, Bible characters and what the story was about. I mean, all that stuff. So, I mean, you know me, I'm a little nerdy. I love school. I've always loved school. So I was a very diligent student. I studied diligently everything that was, you know, that you're given. It's important, I think, to know now that I do know is they do use the Bible, but they also have a lot of accompanying literature that goes along with it. All the books, the Watchtower and Awake magazines, which many people know. So their literature and their books
it's
are
separate
what you
from
study.
The Bible.
Yeah. I mean, it's based off of the Bible, but that is what you are diligently studying.
Okay. So then you get to an age, and what is a typical age of being baptized into it? Because I know in like Catholicism, you're getting baptized as a baby.
Right. Right. And I remember as a young teen, I got baptized at 15 as a young teen thinking this is so much better than the Catholic Church, because the Catholic Church, they baptize you as an infant and you don't have a choice, you know, right? I mean, it can be any age. You can be as young as 8 or 9 or 10 years old, or adults come into it. I mean, my mom was a grown adult when she became a witness and got baptized. So, I mean, there's really no age. I mean, it's obviously very encouraged from a young age that you study and you progress to baptism. That's just the natural progression of the religion there.
So you found that at around age 15 and then made that decision.
I mean, I think people pleaser, and I'm intelligent in what I do. And I had
and at the time you probably really believed, right?
I mean, it had been only 15. And I believed and studied, like I said, you know, I knew the literature, I knew the Bible, I could recite things and believed, I mean, what I had been taught.
So let's talk about that. Like what, because a lot of people, you know, are foreign to what is the belief? What makes it different? What makes that religion different than like Catholicism? I should know that word since I grew up there, or Christian.
I think some of the key things, or some of the big things, is they definitely hold a belief that
Armageddon,
yes. I mean, and that was something very real as a child growing up in that organization. It's a real fear, right?
Yeah.
That God is going to destroy everybody who is not a Jehovah's Witness on the earth that is not. So one good reason to get yourself baptized is you know that if you're not baptized, then you are not, you know.
Is that the same thing as like, so within the religion, somebody asked this question on my Instagram, the 144,000 people that are like, are they
those are believed that they're going to heaven to roll with.
So that's different than the people who are going to live here on paradise.
Yeah. So, I mean, the thought is that at Armageddon, God will come down and destroy everybody who's not faithfully serving him, aka Jehovah's Witnesses. And then you'll live forever in paradise on earth.
And you guys, let me just point out that Mark was like told growing up that he wouldn't like get his driver's license because Armageddon was coming, or like Y2K was kind of happening and like Armageddon was coming. And so like, I think for Mark, all these bench points.
I mean, it is for real in the organization, the history of it. I mean, it's 1975, I think, was when the end of the world, Armageddon, was supposed to come. And I mean, it's very real, and it was very real at that time in the organization. And I grew up thinking, I'm never going to drive a car. I'm never getting married. I'm never going to have children. Here I am, you know, nearing 50, and
we're still here.
Yeah, no, I mean,
do they keep just like kicking the can down the road?
Yes, the can keeps getting kicked down the road.
So like that's how people continue to stay in it.
Yes.
Like, okay.
But when you study this and you believe that that is what's going to happen, I do remember as a young girl, very conflicted about it, because I had a dad who was not a witness. I had half my siblings who were not witnesses.
Which is obviously, you guys, and, like, this is a very unique situation for this religion.
A unique family. I mean, most families are all in it. It's unique that my mom came in, my dad did not, and half the kids did and half the kids didn't. And that we all still, for the most part, you know, remain close in those years. So yeah, I mean, I think it was conflicting. I remember as I was younger thinking, you know, my dad's a good person, my siblings are good people. And I think I kind of just put it aside and went, well, somehow God is going to make sure I'm happy. I'm not going to be unhappy. I think it was later as I started getting into my 20s and my siblings grew up and they had families of their own, and I knew them to be good people. I loved them. They were good parents. They were good spouses. My dad, I loved dearly. He was a wonderful man. And in my 20s, I think I started to really...
intuitively, maybe?
It was very, it was sort of like this internal conflict of how am I going to be happy living forever in paradise if half my family is not there? I mean, it's a very right. real like thought. And I couldn't, when I was younger, I think I could kind of just push it aside and compartmentalize it. And as I got older, I started, it was definitely in
questioning it a little bit.
Yeah. I started to question things.
And here's the thing too, you guys, since their situation was a little bit more unique, one of the things that within this organization they do is they consider anybody outside the religion, quote me if I'm wrong, worldly people. So like Mark growing up didn't play sports. Mark wasn't into extracurricular activities with other people because you really only are supposed to associate with people within the organization. And I don't think that that's by mistake, if I'm wrong, right?
No, I mean, that is, they definitely set up an environment where you are not really supposed to associate or be friends or be close to anyone outside of the organization. So,
and why do you think that is?
Well, it makes it very hard to leave, right? If you know that everybody that you know and love who's in that organization, if you leave, they're going to shun you. You have no one.
Right.
So it makes it very difficult for someone to leave.
And we'll get to shunning in just a minute or in like a little bit.
And there's other things that make it difficult too, I think, especially for women. They don't encourage higher education or careers. So, I mean, a lot of women in that organization, especially, would not be able to support themselves. They're stuck. I mean,
yeah. It's like made to be that way, I would think, without being told that, I feel like. Yeah. And you were also different in that sort of situation because you had your own career.
Yes. From a fairly young age, I fell into something that I absolutely love and eventually went back to school twice. I mean, I went back in my early 30s when I was pregnant with Ava to the JC and got my associate's degree and then took a little break, 10 years, and then ended up progressing to get my bachelor's.
But, yeah.
That's not the norm.
I mean, right. So just to get a good base on what this religion is kind of all about, one of the biggest questions or most asked questions that I got is, why don't people within that religion celebrate holidays? Except for they do celebrate, I will say, anniversaries, like wedding anniversaries, and they celebrate baby showers and wedding showers.
They celebrate a baby shower, but not a birthday.
Yeah.
A baby shower is really a the birthday. First birthday.
Yeah, totally.
Make
sense. So what is the reasoning behind that?
You know, it's interesting. The history of the organization, they were established in the late 1800s, 1870, 80, I think.
Okay.
And there are actually pictures of their world headquarters back in New York, Bethel, New York, of Christmas trees. So at one point they did celebrate Christmas.
Who was the dry sandwich that decided to end this? not to make fun of it, but it's really an interesting situation.
In fairness, most holidays are tied to religion somehow, right? I mean, Christmas is claimed the birth of Christ. Many people today don't believe he was born on December 25th and still celebrate it. A lot of the holidays have pagan roots. So they kind of, they associate anything pagan as, bad. So it was hard for me. I mean, Thanksgiving, I think, was the hardest one for me. I struggled to explain that to anyone. I just hope nobody would ever ask me because, like, of course, we're
thankful.
We're not thankful. We're not thankful.
Yeah.
And I will tell you, being in that religion, many of the witnesses celebrate in some form. They have their turkey dinner on the weekend before, the weekend after. I was even in a book study where we cooked the turkey the night of. so it is kind of bizarre. I don't know.
I remember doing that when your parents still lived at Rolling Oaks and like the Sunday before Thanksgiving.
We'd have turkey dinner.
Yeah, we'd have a turkey dinner and I'd be in the kitchen being a little brat that I am and be like, "Happy Thanksgiving, everybody." Because I'm like, let's just call this shit what it is, you know? You guys would always laugh. That's a good thing about like what was the dynamic of our family was really great because there was always and still always, let's just put that out there, a very much level of respect for one another and their beliefs.
Agree to disagree.
Totally. And religion didn't really get brought up much at all.
No, I think everybody knew kind of where those in were stood. I think there was some level of respect there.
For like the time when I was at a sales meeting with Mark Simpson and it was during Christmas time. So Coca-Cola had a Santa Claus on the front and he said to one of your sisters who was still in the organization, he's like, "Hey, why don't you believe in me?" With like holding up the can to her face and everything.
I think he was gonna,
all in good fun.
He was gonna make t-shirts that say it's Yahweh or the highway.
Yeah, yes. So there's always,
there was always some fun banter.
Totally.
I mean, I think everybody was like.
And some of them are probably thinking, well, yeah, you're not making it to paradise. So joke's on you. But anyways, no, there was always a good level of respect and still is, in some regards. But anyways, so I do have a loaded question for you and you can choose to answer it or not. I have an opinion on this and I'm willing to share where I stand on this question, but if you would rather just not say it, I understand. Would you say that Jehovah's Witness organization is better categorized as a cult than a religion? You can not say if you don't want to. Would you want me to say my thing first?
Yeah, let's go ahead.
Okay.
That would be helpful.
I once heard, I don't know where it was, probably on TikTok or something, but it really struck me. And it was the first time where I was like, that really makes sense to me. I think the difference between a religion and a cult is what happens when someone wants to leave.
Yes.
And if you want to leave and people don't talk to you anymore, or you get put in this corner of we're not allowed to associate with you, that to me differentiates a religion and a cult. So in my opinion, respectfully, I feel that it is somewhat of that. I think they're good people.
Oh, absolutely.
I don't think that they're like gone off the deep end sort of thing, but I do think that how someone exits says a lot about the organization. So
I wouldn't disagree.
Okay. So now that we know a little bit more about the religion, let's get back to your personal story and let's get back to after being baptized, shortly after you met your ex-husband, correct? Like mm-hmm. How old were you when you guys met?
Late teen. I got baptized at 15. I knew him then, but okay. We dated and I got married at 20.
So that's what I was going to ask you about. Within the organization, would you say that it's normal to get married at a very young age?
Absolutely.
Still to this day, do you
yes.
say? Yeah. Probably.
I haven't been in it for 7 years, but I would imagine, yes.
Yeah. And how do you feel about that? Like, what are you looking back now?
I think about me getting married at an early age.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And
just in general, like, would you want your daughter to get married at a young age like that?
I talk to her all the time about that. I'm like, please go live your life. You do not feel any pressure. You don't need to. But I mean, it's important to know that dating in that organization, you don't date to date. You date to find a marriage mate. That is the purpose of it. Otherwise, you should not be dating.
Because you're not supposed to have sex before you get married.
No sex before marriage. And
so that reason alone is probably why a lot of people do get married.
I mean, I think a lot of ones in that organization are either getting into trouble or, or getting married very young.
Yeah, totally. Totally. And unlike Mormonism, like you guys aren't like required to go out on missions or anything like that, right? Or you weren't?
No, not missions, but you are required if you are to be a publisher and a baptized publisher, you were required my whole life. You reported time every month, which I've heard more in November of this last year. They have done away with that, which is shocking and very interesting to me. But no,
so they do not require door to door anymore.
They do.
I know COVID kind of put a halt to that, right?
Yeah, the COVID kind of put an end to knocking on doors. It wouldn't be so PC to do that then. But they have the carts, but they are back, I believe, to door to door. But they've my entire life. I mean, it was every month you turned in a time card on how much you preached, how much literature you placed.
Would you like get in trouble if you didn't meet the requirement?
Yeah, you wouldn't get in trouble. But certainly if you were a man in that organization, that was a gauge of, are you a spiritual man? Can you serve as a ministerial servant or elder if you don't have time? And they would publish the
public
publishers.
Knowledge?
Yeah, the average publishers,
there's some competition.
So there's
going
a little shaming there.
You're
for
doing
sure.
your job.
For sure you felt guilty if you didn't go out.
And as a man, would you say that their goal is to move up to these higher positions within the organization?
Certainly, yes. I mean, that's
you kind of get
you're not spiritually strong. I mean, for a man, if they mature spiritually, then yes, they would be become a ministerial servant and then an elder. And then they have circuit overseers and district overseers. I mean, and it goes all the way up to then,
And are you required to give a percentage of your income to the organization? Or are you is it frowned upon if you don't?
I've heard inklings that I don't know that they do that now, but I mean, for sure, you can donate online. They can, in all the assemblies and stuff, they would talk about that. But it's not
required.
Yeah.
Okay. Like give a certain percentage of your
income.
They're
not going to kick you out if you don't.
No, they want you there. They want you in that seat. So you're married. And how was that throughout your marriage? Like being in the organization, did your ex-husband feel kind of like the same way you did about, was he more in it than you were? Or
no, I don't think he was ever a very spiritual man, quite frankly. I mean, I
sort of lost.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. I want me to delve into a little bit, talk about his
alcoholism?
Addiction? Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
I guess
a lot of people had a lot of questions. If you're comfortable with it.
I think one
of my questions was, when did you start realizing that he had a substance abuse problem?
Okay, almost immediately.
Interesting.
Yes.
Really?
I did not think he was an alcoholic, but I certainly knew he had a problem.
Okay.
And drank too much. Uh-huh. Almost immediately. Now, remember, I lived at home.
Yeah.
I never lived out on my own. At 20 years of age, I get married and move in with him. And
Yeah, so like you didn't take the car for a test drive at all.
No, not at all. And I mean, I came, there were a few things that went on. Like when we got back from our honeymoon that I realized right away that I had no way of kind of knowing before I said I do and married him. And what one was financial issues and mm-hmm. one was his drinking. And I think pretty immediately the financial issues came up. And I mean, I think I was, you know, I was young and naive and I just assumed, and I think, oh gosh, I was really young and somewhat immature. But then I look back and go, God, I kind of had my stuff together at 20 because I worked.
You kind of had to.
I paid my bills. I worked. And even though going from home to moving out on my own, I mean, I was a very kind of self-sufficient, independent person. And I believe that you know, have a credit card, you pay the bill every month. You have rent, you pay the bill.
You're a very responsible person.
I have. And fiscally, I've always been very responsible. And so I just assume that everybody's that way.
Wrong.
Hell no, that is not the case. I married someone that could not be more polar opposite from me, especially when it came to finances. I mean, I did not know this because he didn't bother to tell me, but I mean, he owed everybody money. He owed his parents yeah. money, he owed his roommate money, he owed everybody money. And I mean, we spent the first couple years of our life paying off debt, you know, and I kind of, I think at that time was like, you know, he's young, we're young, like, mm-hmm. you know, maybe he wasn't taught this or right. You know, I don't know, you know, but he'll get it together. And I, you know, here I have a savings. I had a 401k at 20 years of age and contributed to it. So it's like, thought, you know, like he'll get it at some point. And I can say in 22 years of marriage,
he didn't get it.
Never.
And how is being in an organization and you have a spouse that is battling a substance abuse, is it easy to leave them? Because I know divorce is not an easy thing to do within that organization.
Not.
What is warranted for, like, what are the lines of, like, you aren't going to be in trouble, for lack of a better word, to get a divorce if this happens? Like, what are the only things?
Adultery.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's
and
the only thing?
And extreme physical abuse.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So no, I was screwed. I mean, I knew that from the get-go. Yeah. I knew at a very early age. The financial thing was also it. And then I also, you know, we got back from the honeymoon and realized, I mean, he drank a lot. You know, I'd get up and go to work every day and come home every day. And he'd either come home after being out with his buddy and I'd come home and he'd either be, you know, passed out on the couch or whatever. Yeah. And so very early on, I started thinking like, huh. But I didn't know any different. I didn't know any better. And I'd talk to him about it, but he would kind of excuse it. And now it's not a big deal. This is just, you know, and I had not been exposed to alcoholism. So I didn't know. I didn't think he was. I mean, the only kind of knowledge I had of alcoholism was one of my oldest sister, her first husband, who mm-hmm. was Jehovah's Witness, was an alcoholic and he was abusive.
Yeah. And she had kind of an out.
Right. And Troy's not abusive. So mm-hmm. I didn't never. So it's like I correlated like alcoholism with abuse and that's not the case always. So I think I just didn't know, you know, and
did
so
you
I
sort of feel stuck?
Yes. I felt extremely stuck. And I tried talking to him about it and he kind of always dismissed it. And
did you try getting the other people in the religion involved?
No, because I knew there was no, what was I going to do? I mean,
You know, would they believe you as
a
woman?
I will say like in our 20s, I think, he was younger and mm-hmm. healthier. And so I think he could
function.
No, I mean, he could function, right? He had a job, he worked. And I mean, neither of us made any money when we were in our 20s.
Very likable person. And he was a very likable person.
I'm glad you brought that up because I think, you know, I got married at 20 years of age, young and naive, no doubt, admittedly. But I married a man that I was in love with.
Yeah.
And I loved him because he was kind and sweet. And that's what I was attracted to.
Yeah.
And I think most people that knew him would say anything different.
Totally.
He was a sweetheart.
Like
nice guy. I was drawn to that. He was had a very kind and sweet heart. I was not attracted to alcoholics as someone once implied to me that I was. You know, hopefully your therapist can help you figure out why you're attracted to that. Yeah. No, I can assure you, no one that's ever
you got
lived
into a situation,
that,
you had no idea
it
you were
becomes
getting
very unattractive when you've lived with it, especially mm-hmm. for a couple of decades. And
you almost probably feel, and correct me if I'm wrong, but like, do you feel like you're almost like a parent to the person?
Yes, I absolutely was.
I could kind of see
Erica,
that, honestly.
I got married at 20 and I grew up throughout more than two decades we were together. And I can say the man I left was
the man like that you married.
No. And his addiction destroyed everything that I had fallen in love with and loved about him. It had destroyed all of
that. Well, I'm sure. How can you not build resentment through that, you know, and frustration and like battling that, especially if you're with somebody who doesn't see it, doesn't want to help themselves.
No.
Like what you kind of feel like you're at a loss, you know, and now looking back, like now I can see it because I met you when, I mean, it was, you guys were still married for quite a few years.
Yeah.
And so I did get to see it. And I did see that you held everything together.
Yeah, I cared for every aspect of his life. I mean, when we first were married, like I said, in early 20s, he was more functioning. He worked, he contributed. Yeah. As we moved into our 30s, and I would say...
When something tragic happened in our family?
No.
Before
that? I think a misnomer that I've heard family members and whatnot that think they know the intimate details of what went on in a relationship. No, it for sure intensified, but it got to the point in my late 20s, I think I started just, it was a problem. And I would talk to him about it. And I told him repeatedly, this is going to destroy our marriage if you do not get help. And he would deny, you're crazy. I don't have a problem. He would deflect. Your dad's a drinker. My dad was not a drinker. Your brother is, your sister. I mean, it was always this round the circle, someone else, and never a problem. And there was a time when I remember we went to a wedding, some friends' weddings up at the Hilton, and he was wasted. And I was just done. And we got home that night. He insisted on driving home, which I was petrified, and we got home, and of course he passes out. I remember writing him a letter that night and telling him, I can't, this is not what I signed up for. Yeah. And this is not a path I want to go down. And I cannot, if you do not get help, this will destroy our marriage. Mm-hmm.
And was this before you have, or after you had Ava?
This is before I had Ava.
Okay.
And the next morning, of course, he doesn't remember
the
night before, and I want to talk about it, and he doesn't want to talk about it. And I said, if you don't want to talk about it, here, read this. And he ripped it up and threw it away. And
without reading it?
Without reading it.
Nice.
And so we kind of were just in this separate place. I mean, he went to concerts with his brother and Raider football games, and, you know, and I was like in my work, and
you almost led separate lives.
Yeah, I think a part of me just, I felt very helpless and very hopeless. Like, I don't see any way out. I thought about leaving him and leaving
the organization.
At that time. I did. I thought about it a lot.
Yeah. But God kind of had a different plan for you because luckily, look what...
No, I don't have regrets.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, when I go down the path of leaving, it meant I would lose my mom and half my siblings that were in the organization. And I mean,
you almost stayed in it for that.
Yeah,
huh?
I loved them. The thought of having life and not having my family in it, it was very scary and lonely. It was lonely. I mean, there were times where I was depressed, I'm sure, looking back on it. And I mean, there were times where I just felt like, just don't wake up. Like, I never would have harmed myself. Yeah. I was never thinking that, but I didn't see
a way out.
I did not see a way out. I stay in and be miserable and unhappy. And where is this going to go?
Yeah. And my dumb ass didn't pay attention enough to really realize that you're going
to. I don't know that you were. I mean,
I was young too when I came in.
In fairness to people, I think close to my family or whatever, I didn't talk to anybody about it at that time. And I'm a fairly positive person, Erica. I mean, I think even when I was going through horrible things, I've always been someone who's grateful and practices gratitude, and it played a huge role when I went through my divorce. But I think even in those years, life was not horrible. I mean, I spent the first 8 years of my 20s working in an oncology practice, and talk about a humbling experience and making you like appreciate life isn't so bad, you know? So, I mean, I think, and that left a lasting impression on me, and I think kind of molded somewhat who I am.
But you also were in a position where like, you weren't like allowed to do certain things without massive repercussions. It wasn't just about leaving him.
No, I mean,
takes that to a whole new level.
Yeah. I mean, I walked down the path of I felt very helpless and very much like there was no way out.
And in sight.
And so I think, and I can't remember, there was a time kind of around that, or it was when I wrote in the letter, where as much as he never to the day he died, never admitted to me that he was an alcoholic.
Right.
But there was a time period where I kept telling him, like, you need to get help. And we kind of have these conversations. And at one point, I think he knew I was serious. Like, I'm done. I can't do this. And he did admit he drank. On occasion, he would drink too much, and I'll work on it. And I will say, at that time, I thought he did. I really did, because he was not the most motivated person. And I'm a very driven, very motivated person. And he would complain about, hated working for his brother. His brother was kind of an asshole and he didn't like working for him. And I'm like, why don't you go get your own license? He was flooring, contractor. And I'm like, go get your own license and work for yourself. Like, why you know? And so during that time when we had conversations and he kind of admitted that he did, and he said he would work on it. And he did. He went and got his license. He started his own business. And for a few years, 2 or 3 years, I will say that things seemed like they were getting better. What I now realize in retrospect is I don't think he probably made any difference in his drinking. I think he started getting really, really good at hiding it.
Interesting.
And really good at hiding
it. Was this during the time then that you had Ava?
And that's when I got pregnant with Ava. Okay. And I had her in 2008. And it was shortly after I had her that things started not going very good again.
Right.
I think 2008 is when the economy tanked.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
And I remember, it was later that year. And so it was
Zierberg and I got married.
It was very short lived. Yes. Yes. Yeah. She was just a few months old at your wedding. It was later in that year, the economy tanked and his business was not so great. I mean, my career was doing just fine. I was doing good, but his was not. But I remember the interest rates dropped really low. And so it was like a good time to refinance because I could get a lower rate. We'd bought our house years before at a much higher rate. And so I called the loan officer guy that we dealt with and we were working on going through the refi. And I remember he called me up one day at work and he's like, I have some bad news and some good news. What do you want first? And I'm like, give me the bad news first. And he's like, well, the bad news is, I don't know. Troy's got horrible credit. And like, so he can't be on the loan. But the good news is like, you have excellent credit and you can, your salary,
do it
you can
on
carry
your own.
The loan on your own, no problem. And so I'm kind of like, okay, thank you. And I was at work and I get home that day and I was like, holy, how does he have bad, you know, like, how does he have bad credit? And so I like run a credit report on him and shit, you know, 10 credit cards I knew nothing about, $25,000 worth of debt I knew nothing about.
Oh God.
So, you know, things just started coming together. Yeah, like you're not being honest with me. I don't know what's going on. And so, I mean, things just started going from bad to worse then. And that was like 2008. And then a few years later, I mean, when Ava was like 3 or 4 is when our brother-in-law
passed away,
was diagnosed with leukemia. And he had been good friends with Troy. They'd grown up together, very good friends. And no doubt that definitely
it affected everybody.
It affected everybody.
He was
cried for 6 months every day.
It was awful. It was really horrible, really terrible,
horrible thing to go through.
Yeah.
But he, at that point, I think completely checked out on Ava and I. As a husband and a father, I can say he absolutely checked out.
Yeah.
And the following year was a very hard year. My dad was in and out of the hospital and was dealing with heart failure and ultimately Alzheimer's. It was just, I mean, life was a shit show at that time.
So,
it was not a fun time.
Someone asked me, what was your final straw?
I can tell you exactly what it was. About a year before I left him, when the whole credit card thing happened years before, I worked hard and paid every bit of that off. And I said, don't ever do that. I can't do this. You know, like this is not okay. So after Jace in 2013, you know, brother-in-law dies. A year later, my dad dies. You can imagine just the stress. And my husband has completely checked out on Ava and I. And he was dealing with some health issues too. He was diagnosed with hemochromatosis, which...
And he had epilepsy.
Yeah, there was all kinds of things. I was like literally holding our lives together by a string. And he had, over the last several years, had stopped contributing financially to us, which was hard. I mean, I had always managed the bills. When I first married him and realized he was kind of a hot mess when it came to finances, we never joined. 22 years of marriage, and we never had a joint.
Oh, interesting.
No, because I was like,
you can't trust him.
Credit, and I don't want to, like, I'm not going to tie myself
Smart
to
move.
This. So I never, I mean, our bank accounts, credit cards, everything had been totally separate. The only thing was our mortgage. And then I'd been carrying out the loan since 2008. But he was drinking. He was just non-existent in our lives. I mean, he was gone on the weekend, supposedly doing jobs, but yet never had any money. And every time I'd ask, are you going to contribute anything? It was just, you know,
deflect.
Yeah. You know, so and so didn't pay me or this or that. And it got to the point where it was just degrading to me to have to ask. And like, I shouldn't have to ask you.
Kind of give up.
Like, I didn't, you know, like it was just easier not to. And so the year before I left him was really hard. And I remember coming home one day and I was just stressed. I mean, it was basically living on my income and trying to work full time, take care of our daughter and take care of him because he had all kinds of issues. And I was stressed to the max. And I remember one day coming home and get the mail and it's like an Amex card and there's like $2,500 on it from 1 month. And I look and like literally every day is like Benton's Market, liquor store, and
interesting
pub. And I mean, it's like, this is what you're doing all day. Yeah. This is why you don't have a dime to your name and can't help. And I think I just, I was just done.
You
I
were
was just like, I
up.
Cannot do this anymore.
Yeah.
And I called his brother up and I said, you come get him. I can't do this. And his brother came over and talked to him and, you know, and said, hey, why don't you just stop drinking one. I think is, you know, he tried to help.
The problem is if someone doesn't want to help themselves, you're not going to be able to help them.
And he, I don't have a problem. You know, she's crazy. I don't have a problem. And he said, well, okay, but you know, you love your wife and your kid. And if you don't want to lose them, like, just stop. Okay, I will. And so, you know, and he's not going to. And a month later, he comes back in the house with the six pack under his arm. And I'm like, oh, I thought you were going to stop. Oh, I didn't say I was going to stop. I mean, like, it's that kind of crazy. Like,
it's probably really hard.
I learned through therapy later on that addicts are master manipulators. Right. And when
their addiction
explained to me, it was like, oh, it wasn't, I'm not going crazy. I would ask him questions about his work week and it was always a different story. Like, it got to the point where it's like, I knew he was always lying to me. So I couldn't.
What were you to do?
Asking. Yeah. I mean, it was just, so the year before I definitely was like, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. And I had confided in a couple other family members prior to leaving him. And the weekend that I ultimately left him was in January. And I'll never forget. I had come home on Friday. Ava was nine, almost nine. I think she's eight at the time. And she turned nine in June. He had come home from work. I worked from home on Fridays. He had come home from work and drove himself home and parked and came in the house and wasn't slurring a speech and wasn't like stumbling all over the place. And I was supposed to go on a business trip that following Monday for an FDA audit. And so I had to go get a few things ready for my trip and whatever. And so I left to go to CVS and grab a few things and was gone. And I came back like an hour later and he was sitting on the couch and was completely like passed out, like could not even hold his head up. And I'm kind of like, and there's a glass of wine sitting there and I'm thinking like, it's not an hour. Like there's no way he, you know, and I'm sitting there and I remember sitting on the coffee table and looking at him. And I just had a lot of mixed feelings. I was furious because Ava, our daughter, was in the next room. And I thought, this is it. I can't do this. But I knew in order to leave, I needed two witnesses. Because if I went to the elders and said, he's got a drinking problem, they would go talk to him and he'd say, no, I don't. And that would be end of the story. So I called my sister and her husband. He was an elder at the time. They were in it. And I called his brother and his wife. And they came over. I said, I need help. And they came over and they looked at him and they were like, I've never seen anybody in the state. And I'm like, I've seen this many times before. Mm-hmm. And we got him up and got him to the car and he needs to go to the doctor. You know, we took him to the ER and 4 or 5 hours in the ER and, you know, brain scans and urine samples and blood tests. And the ER doctor finally comes in and she says, well, the good news is, you know, your heart checked out fine and blah, blah, blah. And by this time he's like sobered up and, you know, 5 hours and peeing like a racehorse for his urine sample for 20 minutes. And she comes in and she asked everybody to leave the room. And I was like, I know what this is. I work in the medical field my whole life. I know what's going on here. And so my sister and my brother-in-law were there with us and they left. And she got called out really quickly. And I peeked into the curtain and I looked at him and I said, when she comes back, I'm going to be in here because whatever's going on, I'm going to hear it.
Yeah.
And I mean, he didn't have the wherewithal to say no at that point. And so she came back and my sister and my brother-in-law were not still in the room. She had asked them to leave, but she said, you know, your brain scan was fine. Your heart's checking out fine, but your blood alcohol is 0.38.
Jesus Christ.
I didn't know what that meant. I looked at her and isn't I was like, I don't know. It's like
4 or 5 times over the like.
Oh God. It's like almost 40% of the fluid pulsing through your body is alcohol basically. Yeah. And I looked at her cause like, I didn't know what that mm-hmm. meant. And she said, if it were you or I, we'd be dead.
Oh wow. So his body had gotten
and
so used to it.
She looked at him and she said, the fact that you're alive and you're somewhat coherent here and functioning tells me that you're doing this on a regular and consistent basis.
And that's probably all you need to hear to be like,
yeah. And I was like, ding, I'm not crazy. I know because he didn't. But then I was talking to the ER nurse after she left and she looked at him and she said, you seem like a nice guy and you obviously have people here who love you. If you do not stop drinking, you will kill yourself. And I knew that. I saw him deteriorating and I saw that's where it was headed. And left. And then his brother and I were kind of talking to the ER doctor because I'm like, how did he drive himself home? And he was not slurring. He was not doing this. And the ER doctor kind of explained to us. He said, you know, his blood alcohol is never zero. He probably wakes up in the morning and it's not. And a lot of it started like clicking, like, oh, him waking up in the middle of the night, sweating and shaking. He was going through withdrawals. I mean, we'd go to assemblies and he, by the end of the day, was like,
I remember
literally,
him always shaking.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that was withdrawal. I mean, if he didn't have alcohol, that's what he was doing. And that's what the ER doctor explained. And he said he has figured out how to get himself home. And then literally the 1 or 2 glasses of wine that you see him drinking are what's
pushing him
over the limit and nearly killing him.
So then you decide to leave. And still at this point, when you decide to leave, because I remember that when that
we
all happened.
We got home that night. He crashed. The next morning, I laid awake in bed all night and I knew what I was going to do. And the next morning he got out of bed and I'm off to my job. And I said, no, you need to pack a suitcase. And he goes, what are you talking about? And I go, no, we're done. You're not coming back in the house.
And at this point too, it was very apparent. It was very apparent to all of us. Like,
I think so.
But would you say at this point, like, the religion would support you on leaving him? Or no?
No, no. And here's the thing. So I told him to pack a bag and get out. And even then was like, ER doctor didn't know what she was talking about. Excuse, I only had two drinks left. And I was like, no, we're done. Get out. And a series of events happened over the next week. He went to a rehab center, walked out. And when he left the rehab center, he was supposed to be in for 45 days. He went through 7 days of medically supervised detox and then walked out and showed up at our house that night smelling of alcohol. So I knew I needed to protect myself legally. He was driving, he was drinking. And so my sister and I went down to the courthouse the next morning and I had to file for,
a divorce.
And I remember vividly sitting there in the courthouse with the paperwork in front of me and it's dissolution of marriage. And there's two boxes, there's separation and divorce. And I'm kind of like just in this trance staring at it. My sister's like, what's wrong? I don't know what to check. And she kind of looked at me like, you're not going to take him back, are you? I mean, and I go, no. And at that point, our marriage had been destroyed. I didn't trust him. I mean,
and you were almost to the point where you're willing to lose everything because you're just done. You had a daughter to deal with.
And so she's like, well, just check divorce. And I know she had no way of understanding or comprehending what I was thinking, but I knew there was a huge difference in me checking separation and divorce as far as the religion is concerned.
What did separation you check?
I checked divorce.
Thank God. And
I knew once I made that decision that a whole series of events would unfold. I knew that in
Let's
that religion.
Let's talk about that because I think a lot of people want to know, all right, so you needed clearly made the best decision for you and your daughter, but even so, what you experienced, what I witnessed you experienced, to me was unbelievable, for lack of a different term. I can't still to this day understand when a person is in the position you were in, instead of being what they needed to be to you, which is supportive, all of your friends within that organization, I could cry for you because I watched it and I like, it was really hard for me as your sister to watch you go through this because what you needed most was support. And thank God, you did have people that weren't within the religion that could be there to fall on. Because can you guys imagine, or can you even imagine, Annie, women that are still stuck in this because they don't have what you kind of did have?
Right.
You know, I want to understand this aspect of the religion because I still to this day have yet to get a good description that has changed my mind. Why do they shun people?
It's a form of discipline.
Okay.
Although in my situation, I was not disfellowshipped. I did not do anything. I mean,
okay. So explain what that is because not a lot of people know what
so,
that is.
So disfellowshipping is you sin and you sit before a committee, three elders, and they basically judge whatever happened and they decide it's
all men.
You're unrepentant. All men. Yeah. The only ones that hold powers and authority in that organization. And
how embarrassing.
And then they announce it to the Kingdom Hall, you know, to the congregation. So everybody knows.
And then if you get disfellowshipped, don't you like, there's like usually like a penance of like, or time that it's for so long, right?
Yeah, I don't know how long. No, and I've known different people that have been disfellowshipped and then they can come, you know, if they go to all the meetings and they show that they're repentant, then they can be welcomed back into.
And they will show up to meetings and they have.
And
they,
no one will talk to them.
And they'll like sit in the back?
Yeah, usually. I mean, that's usually what would happen. But yeah, I mean, I don't agree with it.
Did you not agree with it when you were in it too?
Yes, I absolutely did not agree with it. And I will say it was always very awkward and very hard because I think it's cruel.
I mean, because you and I know that people.
Destroys lives.
Yeah.
People lose after they've been, they're alone. I, again, was in a very unique situation. I had half my family who was out and they're ready to support me and love me and help me through this hard time. And my family, some of my family was supportive of it as well. But the vast majority, I mean, for the first time in my life, I dedicated my entire life to this organization. I had cared for people when they were sick and taken dinners and done the whole shebang. And there was very few. I mean, and some of my ex-husband's brothers were very loving and still are to this day. I mean, I think that's important to know. They did not shun me and they do not. And they're very loving and very, very supportive. But the vast majority, and I think I was a little surprised. I didn't I mean, I know in a divorce, kind of like people take sides or whatever, you know, and I didn't want anyone to shun or not love Troy. I mean, he needed support. I could not give that to him anymore. And, you know, when I started seeing a therapist before I left him in the year before I left him. And that is what really helped me, because I started to realize that I was enabling him. And enabling is with an addict. Anytime you support them in a manner where they don't feel the consequences of their addiction, right? And he wasn't. I mean, he came home to a beautiful, well-kept home. I did his laundry.
It's in a safe place.
Yeah. I mean, he had every aspect of his life I took care of. So he was never going to feel the effects of what it's like to drink your life away when he was living when we were married. I mean, there was no way. And I didn't know I was enabling, I think, at the time. But then once I started going to therapy, it helped me realize that he's never going to get better or think he needs to if I continue this path.
So what was the fallout? So what was that like? I mean, you did have the support, but
I mean,
you were lucky because you worked with, like, you had work friends.
Yes,
you did have, like, other people.
I had work friends, but mind you, my whole life I had been taught you can't get really close to those people. So yes, I had worked with wonderful people and they're wonderful friends, but it wasn't like, I mean, I had always kept them kind of at a distance, right? Because you're not really supposed to associate with worldly people. They're bad. And, you know, and so, and it, interestingly enough, I found quite the opposite to be true. The people who showed up for me and were there for me and were supportive of me were these incredible people that I had known and worked with for 20 years and my boss. And I mean, they were all extremely supportive and cared and were there for me. And so, I mean, I started realizing people do love you outside of that, you know, which is not what you're taught and told. Only the only people that love you are the people that are in this organization. And what I learned is it's a very conditional love, right? It's we love you as long as you think and feel and do as we think you should. And the minute you don't, it is literally like a switch that gets flipped and it's off.
Yeah. And so how did you go about not getting disfellowshipped?
Well, I didn't do anything wrong. I mean, when I left him, I mean,
technically you weren't supposed to get a divorce.
No,
right?
Divorcing him, I didn't have scriptural grounds for divorce. And so years ago, they used to mark women that do that. They'd give a talk in the hall. And so it's like, they wouldn't, because it's not a disfellowshipping offense. I didn't sin. There was nothing that I did that was sinning, but it was you're going against their teachings.
And so it would be like a public announcement.
And like you're
like a scarlet letter.
Yes, that's exactly what it's like. And people know, like, oh, you've divorced. That's a rogue woman, you know, like that's not what a woman is supposed to do in that organization. And some were still very caring and very loving, but I was definitely kept at an arm's length. I mean, here I went through this horrible situation and found myself alone, a single mom. We worked full time. I never got a dime of child support from my ex-husband. And so stressed and the one time where I really could have used love and support and it was not.
Probably
there.
Very eye-opening.
Yeah, it was eye-opening. I mean, and people didn't shun me in the congregation that I went to, but I mean, I didn't get, nobody invited me over. Nobody asked me anywhere. Like, they don't want to touch you. I mean, it's soft shunning, basically. It's like, but then I was directly shunned. I remember going the last convention that I went to, which is like these all day like Bible talks. And Ava and I went with my sister and her husband and their kids. And I wish I had my own car because I would have turned right around. But we walked through the door and it was hard enough. I was exhausted. I was working full time. It was on a Saturday.
You're kind of on the
get up at the crack of dawn. And I was already feeling like, what am I doing? And so it's hard enough to just drag yourself and get there anyways. And I remember walking through the door and my sister and her husband and their family were in front of us. And the sister comes up that I've known my whole life, mind you. And she's known me my whole life. And she hugs my sister and as soon as she sees me, she turns and looks and walks the other way. And then I take a few more steps in and I see a brother. He's an elder and he was a very good friend of my ex-husband's. And both of these people I'd had over to my home for dinner. I'd been in their homes for dinner. I mean, I knew them and he sees me and beelines and walks the other way. And I literally was like, oh, I wish I had my car. I would turn around and leave.
Blood
and took
boiling.
I was hurt.
Yeah.
It was painful.
Yeah.
I'm like, it took every bit of strength I had to get to my seat and like sit down. I didn't want Ava to see me cry. I didn't want anybody. I mean, I was literally ready to just crumble because you're in this building full of hundreds of people and it's supposed to be a house of love and God, you know? And it's like, I didn't understand, like, I don't expect you to hate him, but what is treating me this way doing? What is that accomplishing? It was very hard for me to understand.
Especially when you're in such a vulnerable time as it is. Like,
right.
Jeez. And to feel that shame and, you know,
everybody's gossiping.
And not everybody did this, I don't think, to you.
No, certainly not. And I think, you know, and some people, I'm sure, people may think that I left because of that, because I was not treated kindly by many people or whatever, you know. I can assure you that is not why I left. If I believed in their teaching and the doctrine, everybody in that organization could have shunned me and not, and I would still be faithful to that organization. But what it did do is it caused me to start all these other doubts and kind of thoughts that I had had in my 20s and 30s. My mind started opening up and I'm like, this cannot be the true, I mean, this is not love. This cannot be the right thing. And so I started kind of unpacking like this. And I remember a very good friend of mine, she just had, her and her husband and family had left as well. And I remember having conversations with her and she said something that was very important. And hopefully if anyone's listening and kind of going through this now, I hope it was the best piece of advice to give. She said, give yourself permission to do some research, Nanette. If you have doubts, if things don't make sense to you, you should be allowed to look into that and either prove it wrong or right or whatever. And,
oh my God, I just got the chills because I feel like people need to do that about a lot of things in the world.
Anything. If you're not feeling comfortable with something.
In fact, when something's really uncomfortable, that's when you should lean into it more.
That's when you should start questioning it. And I was at this place in my life where I'm making these huge life decisions. And so it's, I started Googling and I started looking at things. And in that organization, you are told absolutely you are not to look out anywhere out.
That should be a red flag, right?
Yes. If anyone says, here's what we teach and here's what you need to believe. And oh yeah, by the way, you cannot look anywhere else. Yes. I mean, I know logically and now that I'm on the other side, it seems kind of crazy. But when you're in it, you're told that anything outside
to win it
is Satan. It is apostasy. It is bad. And they are there trying to destroy it, you know, so you shouldn't. And I mean, mind you, I grew up in a time where there was no Google, there was no internet. So you didn't have access to, you couldn't fact check things. You couldn't.
Now they're like screwed.
Now it's much harder to hide.
Yeah.
Hide
some of the things
now.
That go on for
and,
sure.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think at that time, the Australia Royal Commission was going on. And I mean, the reality is I didn't have to look into any, I didn't go looking for apostate stuff on mainstream news and you could find things that definitely helped me understand, you know, my doubts and things that I was questioning and things that I saw and things that didn't seem right. I think I started to like question things and they were, like I said, the Australian Royal Commission is, I don't know if you know what that is, but it was a huge court case in Australia on child sex abuse in not just Jehovah's Witnesses. It was, it was Catholic Church. I mean, a whole bunch of organized religions were being investigated. And so it was very public. I mean, it was all over the news. And I think when I started looking at that and reading, and they have members of the governing body that took the witness stand and
still hit it.
Interesting. Yeah. And I think it was, I mean, when you start uncovering kind of that, and I remember like reading up on that and educating myself on what had gone on. And I remember thinking like, look, it doesn't just go on in that organization. It goes on. No. I think in any organized, anything where you have men or women of power and access to children, sadly and sickly, that's a possibility.
100%.
I think the difference is I grew up in that organization and I can vividly remember reading Watchtower articles, I can't remember if it was like 80s or 90s when the Catholic Church, like all of the pedophile issues and stuff going on in the Catholic Church was very, you know, public knowledge. It was all over the news and they were getting into a lot of trouble with it. And I remember there being an article where they were basically condemning the Catholic Church for it and how horrible it is that this goes on. But it doesn't happen in our organization. Our children are protected and our children are safe. And that's not true.
Right.
They have covered up their...
Like, Google it.
Yeah, Google it. It's not true.
You can probably uncover things. So I think leaning into these things, especially if you're in it and you're questioning it, you know, like.
Yeah, to pretend that, no, this doesn't go on. Yes, it does. And it was being mishandled. They didn't view the elders would manage those cases if a victim, a child.
And not bring it to like law enforcement.
No, they viewed it as a sin, but not a crime. And so they would take care of it internally. And unfortunately, what that means is you could be sitting in a congregation and there could be a pedophile there, but they're not listed. They're not registered sex offenders because they've never reported it to authorities.
So that's problematic.
Yeah, it's a problem.
Yeah. And again, like she said, we obviously are aware that this goes on in really every single religion.
Absolutely.
I bet you.
No.
You know, because people are sick. But so after all of this, like, what would you say got you through it all?
Therapy.
Okay. And what advice would you give your daughter, any woman for that matter, that is going through something similar to you that you are?
I think there are moments where I just felt so helpless and hopeless, but I think it's important to know that people do care about you. Find your people, find your support system.
They're out there even though you...
Right. Yeah. And you find strength. I mean, in that whole... I mean, after I went through my divorce, I then decided I'm going to go back to school and finish my degree. Like, it wasn't easy. There's no easy. It's I won't sugarcoat it. It was not easy to get through that. And I came out on the other side and I think I'm...
You're doing great.
I'm a success story. I'm happily married. I have a wonderful family. My life is really... I'm healthy and happy. And it took years of therapy. I mean, I went to therapy weekly for I don't know how long. I mean, the first visit with my therapist, when I kind of told him a few of what was going on, he looked at me and he goes, "Okay, I think I'm going to need to see you weekly." And I was like, "Oh,
yes, I got a lot to unpack here, buddy."
And it's hard because it's vulnerable, right? You have to be willing. I mean, therapy only works if you're open and honest
totally.
And looking at yourself and that. But I mean, that it did save me. It helped me unpack kind of all the indoctrination. It's hard to come out of something where it's been in your head since you were little and you do feel a little bit like...
40-something years of being told something.
And I didn't want to come out of it and have these fears of like, oh, am I going to die? I wanted to come out of it healthy. And for my daughter, I wanted her to see that, like, if you're in a situation that you don't agree with or doesn't feel right, then you have the right to question it and get out of it.
I would say, again, you can correct me because I'm kind of speaking for you if I'm wrong, but that you are stronger than you think.
Absolutely.
Because you felt broken going into this for sure, like you described. But watching you stand up and take the reins and do what you did is so admirable. I am so incredibly proud of you. And your daughter and my daughter even, and my son even, and me are so lucky to have witnessed you do what you do. And you are such a good role model. And I'm so fucking proud of you.
Thank you.
You've come such a long way. And it's just so great to see how happy you are and how amazing your child is through all of this. She is so unbelievable and so smart and so compassionate for the world. And it's just amazing.
Incredible. I mean, I think a lot of those big decisions, getting out of the toxic and, relationship and then getting out of a belief system that did not align with me. She was always at the forefront. Like, I can't stay in this. I don't want her to see her father drink himself to death. And that is what ended up happening.
Yeah.
And, but it wasn't going to be
in my home
in front of my child.
Yeah.
It just wasn't. And so, I mean, I think anybody, hopefully if they're listening and some of this resonates with them or they're in a difficult situation, I would say, you find this inner strength and don't get me wrong. I mean, I had my moments where I was like, I had days where it was like, God, my life sucks. how the hell am I going to get through this? And I think it's kind of like that choose your heart, right?
I can keep on keeping on, man.
Yes. My Papa was keep on keeping on. But also I think it's like you choose your heart, right? Like staying in was not fun and there was nothing easy about staying in that.
Yeah.
And so I had to like look at the long term goal, and this is not the life I want. And I think everybody has the right to decide that. I think it's interesting. I've had several people make comments that, oh, you left him and you kicked him to the curb. And I will very much kind of set the record straight here. He left us long before I left him. And it was just...
And there was adultery going on in some sort of like metaphoric sort of way. He was cheating on you with alcohol.
I think my brother-in-law, who was a witness, it told me, he had the greatest love affair with alcohol.
Yeah.
And he did.
Sad.
And that's interesting too, because I know that in the confines of that religion, adultery is like the worst thing you can do. And that, I'm here to tell you, I mean, I haven't lived through that, so I can't speak to that alone. But what I can tell you is it did everything and then some of what adultery would do, right? There's lying. You're not being honest with the person. But more than that, I mean, I think you can go through adultery and a person can still be a good parent to their child. And his addiction destroyed his ability to be that.
I mean, totally.
He lived the last 4 years of his life not seeing his child.
Right.
And being no part of her life.
Yeah. It's sad. It's a terrible, terrible disease.
It's
awful.
It is an awful
disease. Yeah, it is. So would you maybe afterwards, or like you can send me any sort of like books or things that you read that I can leave in the show notes for people that helped you if you read anything, because I know you're a big reader.
Yes, I'm a huge reader. I read a ton.
Yeah, so if there are certain things, I would love to include that in my show notes. Mm-hmm. And so if you are seeking to ask questions if you're in something like this and need some resources. I'll make sure that I get that from Nanette. But to lighten the mood a little bit, I've been asking somebody or everybody this question at the end of season two. And so, and you guys, she does not know that I'm asking her this question, so I'm putting her on the spot. But what is your favorite sandwich? What is it made up of? Like, okay, you're going to Oliver's or you're going to like, you know, like Honey Sliced Ham. What are you ordering?
I like turkey and avocado.
Okay, what kind of cheese?
Havarti.
Okay, what kind of bread?
Like a sliced sourdough or a good multigrain.
Are you getting like everything on it or are you like minimal?
I'm unlike you. I'm not. I'm kind of anti-mayonnaise. So.
What? What do you get? A lot of mustard?
A little mustard.
A little, Nanny, this sounds a little dry. Like,
sorry. Avocado. No, like if I go to Lazzini's market, okay, I love Lazzini's. And Ava and I love, like, actually, we get a roast beef on usually Dutch
Wait,
crunch.
I introduced
there.
Her to
I know
this.
You did. She used to take her there when you'd pick her up from school. And she, you'd be shocked at how much the kid could put down.
She's like, I want a roast beef sandwich. You want a half? No, I want a whole.
I think
yeah, and I'm like, okay, you're my kind of girl.
She's still to this day can out eat me.
That is so funny.
Yeah, but no, they have a garlic aioli. It's ooh, spread, yeah. And okay, I do like that. I don't know what I have a version.
Oh, very, very nice. All right. I'm going to have to go there and try their garlic aioli. You know that they got bought out, though?
No.
Yeah, they got bought out. So their bread's kind of changed.
Oh, they yeah. That, I didn't know they got bought out, but they did change the whole thing.
It's not as good as it once was. Kind of disappointing. Yeah. But they do make a good sandwich. I will say that. So, well, yeah. I want to say thank you so much for being here. I know that this wasn't an easy thing for you to do, but I truly believe that you will touch people's hearts, and your bravery, I hope, will encourage people to be brave too. So thank you so much for sharing your story, and I'm very proud of you, and I love you.
Love you too.
All right, friends, that's all for today's episode of the Whiskey and Lace podcast. If you liked what you heard, please share the love and leave a review. And remember to join the Whiskey and Lace community by following me on TikTok and Instagram at Whiskey and Lace. And send me a DM to say hi and mention this episode. I'd love to meet you. See you next week.